This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 125. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer. Today, you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world, from all different skill levels. Everybody sitting down, ready to nerd out for 40 minutes and learn photography. To talk about today's topics, I'm joined by Nick Page, Jeff Harmon, Darren Meller, and a new voice on the show is Rob Kruger from Take and Talk Picks, who will be joining us today. So welcome, everybody.
Thanks.
Hello, hello.
Hey.
Well, it's been a fun week at Improved Photography. We finished our contest on Instagram. If you haven't followed me yet at Jim Harmer, it's starting to get personal. But we finished the contest and we are working now on editing the photo. So stay tuned to our YouTube channel for that. But we want to jump right into today's topics. We have some questions from listeners of the show. We're going to talk about those and then we'll get into the main segment where we're going to talk about your top 10 photos of all time. So first, Darren, you put this question in here. Rob, I might throw this one to you, though, because this is D800. This is Nikon territory. This says Sue Pollard, who we met in China, says she shoots a Nikon D800, and she says, I have real problems getting sharp images through the viewfinder. I've tried everything, shutter speeds, lenses, tripods, triggers, and everything through live view, everything is fine. But it looks like through the viewfinder, she's having trouble. Where would you point her, Rob?
Glasses first, I think, is the... No, I'm just kidding. Don't do that. So, I mean, there's adjustments for the viewfinder. Maybe something got bumped there. But I know Nikon has had a few issues with cameras. Their D7000 had some back focus issues for a while. And then some people got handfuls that were okay. Maybe it needs to be looked at. You know, I mean, seriously, that could be the issue. I don't know why Nikon's having those issues. They're supposed to be making cameras, right? And they can't get them to take clear pictures at certain points. But I'd bring it in to be looked at because it sounds like a unique problem that wouldn't be something that would be fixable if all those other things didn't do the trick.
Yeah, I don't know. This is really weird if your photos through the viewfinder are all out of focus and through in live view are. I mean, technically, there's a big difference between how those pictures are taken, because when you're shooting in live view mode, you're only using contrast detection autofocus, at least in the D800. Some cameras now are using phase detection even when you're shooting in live view, but most cameras are only using contrast detection autofocus when you're in the live view mode, because the mirror is flipped up, and with the mirror flipped up, it can't actually send that information to the phase detection sensors, which are at the, like when you take your lens off and you're looking at the camera, it's at the bottom. You can see some electrical contacts there, and that's where your phase detection mechanism is. So it's very different how those two focus mechanisms work. Is it theoretically possible that something has just messed up with your phase detection autofocus? Yes, but that's not a real common problem. I can't say that I've ever seen that happen. So I guess before I'd send it in and spend money on it, I might just take this to somebody who's more experienced. Come back to China with us next year. Wait a whole year, Sue. Find a photographer who's experienced. Go to a photo walk and find somebody who knows what's going on and just say, hey, well, what's going on here? And maybe take a look at it and see if we can work through that. But that's definitely not a common issue by any means.
Right.
All right, Darren, I'm throwing this one to you. Eric Frame, who we met in Oregon, said, I'm shooting my first car shoot in a studio. I'll be using one or two Einstein strobes and a 36x24-inch softbox. I've noticed a lot of people use long strip boxes when they're shooting cars. What's the best way to go? Any ideas of how to get rid of the reflections? What do you think, Darren?
I would do it in post-production, but that's probably not the correct answer. I think that the best answer would be to just try to make the light as soft as possible. He did recommend using some black fabric or something like that, maybe even throwing a grid on there to a certain degree to see what different effects you can use could possibly lead you to get reflections where you want them and remove reflections to where you don't. And I brought this to Nick's attention as well. I brought this on the episode for Nick as well, because I think that Nick would really have a good answer on this. this because he's probably shot cars and he's going to be doing this in a garage. So what are your thoughts, Nick?
Well, I've shot cars, but they were all like old and rusty. So shining cars are new. But the reason that they use the really long strip boxes is because they actually want those reflections to be there.
Exactly.
And so the long strip boxes are going to create that nice flowing contour highlight on whatever contour you're shooting. So that's why you see those really long strip boxes used for cars. Is
and the reason they're huge is they don't want the square showing up. They want it to run the full length of the car.
Right. So if you're going to use something that is kind of square or octagon shaped, you're either going to, like Darren said, have to remove it in post or really pay attention to like your angles, because I'm sure I can't work it out in my brain, but I'm pretty sure that there's a way that you could put it at such an angle that it wouldn't create a really annoying reflection in the car. So you know, doing something like almost backlighting it and rim lighting it, that's something that you could do with this setup. Yeah. Or another option is if you're going to be doing it indoors in a studio, you could always light paint it and you could kind of mimic the long strip box thing just by moving your light source. So that's something
a cool idea, actually. You know, with a flashlight, if you were going to light paint it, I might do something cool. It could be kind of weird though with the you know, light going everywhere. But that's a cool idea to kind of light paint with a softbox, that if you turned a softbox on like a continuous light and started in one spot and put it on wheels, like, you know, how you often get a light stand on wheels in a studio, and just wheel it through the scene. Now it's not a small softbox, it's the full length of that softbox. That'd be way cool. That's a good idea, Nick.
Awesome. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Or, you know, even something larger, a larger light source than your typical flashlight. So maybe like a big long fluorescent work light, maybe that would work. That way it's not, you know, not that small, because a flashlight is just going to be like a line, just a really sharp line on the car, which won't be appealing. But a big long work light moved during a long exposure, that could be cool.
Yeah, really good ideas. When I was working with Dusty O, makes me sad every time I say that. with Dusty O, he loves cars. And so we shot a lot of cars together. And it really is, I mean, most cars, the way that they're painted today, it's basically a mirror finish. I mean, it's going to reflect. You're going to get the reflections on there. You can kind of try to remove them. It's going to make the car just look flat as a pancake. I think you want those reflections on there. One thing that we did to shoot the cars is we found a you know, multi-tiered garage, you know, like a parking garage. And we would go like in the middle tier. So you know how they usually have really low ceilings in those parking garages? And then boom, that's a huge softbox. And we would just get bare flashes and bounce them off the ceiling in a parking garage. And now it's humongous, as big as you want for the light. So that worked really well. And kind of being in a parking garage kind of made sense for an automotive shoot as well. So you may look at a different kind of space than you may otherwise use, so that you could have something like that low ceiling. I've also seen photographers build, if you really want to go crazy, but you want to go DIY on this, I've seen photographers get a muslin, like, you know, a white muslin, like you're going to use for portrait photography, a backdrop. I mean, those are huge. They're like 10 foot by 20 foot, which I'm sure everybody in all our international users are annoyed by me saying that, but I'm not sure what it is in meters. It's big, okay? and would just tie it up above the car and then hang the speed lights off the ceiling. So they're using the muslin as the softbox baffle, and they're just shooting a bunch of speed lights down onto the muslin, and that produced some really, really cool results. I can't remember who I saw was doing that. Somebody online was doing that, and I thought that was a really interesting approach to it. So there are a lot of different ways that you could do this. You just got to think a big light source, so that you don't have, you know, just like this umbrella that's, you know, it's going to be really clear that it's an umbrella right in the middle of the photo. Jeff, you ever shot cars or anything like that?
No, I've never shot any cars so far.
You're not much of a car guy, huh?
Not enough of those rolling down the mountainside in Utah here.
What kind of man are you to not have shot cars, dude?
Oh. Well, I does shooting with a shotgun count?
There you go.
All right.
I've done that out in the west side of Utah Lake here, so.
Nice.
All right, Rob, the next question is about Lightroom. We have somebody who's moving their Lightroom collection from a PC to a Mac. Now, I'm just going to toss in there that it really won't matter going from PC to a Mac. We're just talking about moving one computer to another. How would you suggest somebody do that? You know, I just bought a brand new computer. I want to move my Lightroom collection over. How does that happen?
Well, you have your collection and catalogs in Windows is really helpful in making those folders for you that you can actually search those folders and integrate them right into your new spot, you know, so you can find those source files pretty quickly of where they're located. I mean, as long as you've been keeping up on your collections and making those sets, you know, for each job, it becomes very easy to port that over or at least copy those files over. But then it becomes down to Lightroom having the directory. So it needs to find that path. So create the same or similar path from the certain drive letters or, you know, folder names, things of that nature, because it could get a little bit confused when it's trying to look through the same path if you're porting the same stuff over. So
yeah, so this question is a little bit tricky because the way he asked it, he says he's moving his Lightroom collection. And I think what he means is he's moving his whole Lightroom library over. Collection is a term of art. In fact, I happen to know that Jeff Harmon has an episode of Photo Taco that he just talked about collections. So Jeff, maybe to kind of help out the question itself, tell us about a Lightroom collection and why maybe that's confusing the question a little bit.
Okay, so the broader category is catalog. That's what Rob was mentioning. Right. And so it used to be a while ago, too, that people recommended having multiple catalogs for your photos. You could maybe do landscape versus portraits versus wedding or ships versus cars or whatever, however you wanted to break it up, because when you got a lot of them in there, it slowed things down a lot. I don't think that's the case anymore. The recommendations, and I mean, I've got, I don't know, 50,000 pictures in the catalog, and it doesn't seem to be any different than when I had one. So I don't think that's a problem anymore, but that's kind of the broad category. All of the photos that you bring in are under a catalog, and that's what you'd want to move if you're moving from one PC to the other. Collections then are grouping things inside of that. And it's not something that is done at a file level. It doesn't have anything to do with the files on your file system, on your computer. It is a categorization you make where you're grouping certain photos together. And one of the great things about it is that it doesn't have to reflect what's on your file system on your computer. So you can have one photo qualify to be in your vacation photos and also qualify to be in your landscape photos. If it's a great shot you took on a vacation of a landscape, then you could have it be in both collections without having to have it be the same picture in two different directories on your computer. So it's a really great way to be able to organize your photos so that you can find them fast, you can narrow down what it is, get it categorized, grouped into things that make sense so you know where things are.
So he's wanting to move everything. So I think probably the reason he was having a tough time finding it is he was searching for how to move a collection, and he's really just wanting to move the whole catalog.
Right.
I'm the worst about this. I say sometimes library when I mean a catalog. They're really the same thing. And yep. Aperture, Apple's Aperture, it was called a library, and Lightroom calls it a catalog. And then there are these collections. So there's reason for the confusion, but that's what's going to need to happen for this.
So one of the things I'd probably say to look at would be Lightroom has the capability to export a catalog. You can export a collection as a catalog too if you wanted to send off a certain collection of photos for mm-hmm. some people to ship that off for other people to do the post-processing so you don't do it yourself. And that's a common way to do that. But if you exported the whole catalog, you'd make sure that you got everything kind of in one nice little package to move over to the other computer. You don't have to worry about catching it yourself.
And so when you move it over, all you need to find is that Lightroom, the LRCAT file, LRCAT. That's your Lightroom catalog, and that has everything in it. The photos are where they are on the computer. So you'll just put your Lightroom, the LRCAT file, it's a big file, on the new computer. And then you'll move your photos over separately. And like Rob was saying, you'll try to keep the the directory that it's in, the folder that it's in, you know, the same naming convention and stuff. If you can, then that's great. You're just ready to go. As soon as you get that LRCAT file in, you're going. But often it's going to change the drive letter or something like that. And so Lightroom, that LRCAT file is going to say, ah, the photos aren't where I remember them being. And so on that new computer, you're just going to have to move, use the move tool in your library, and you're going to move where they were on the old directory to the new one, and then you're ready to go. Everything's set. All right, that's Lightroom. If you ever have to move your catalog, hopefully we have pointed you at least in the right direction. In a minute, we want to talk a little bit about your putting together your portfolio and getting a top 10 photos of the year put together. I think it's a great idea and something that Jeff is going to walk us through a little bit. But before we do that, we want to remind you about the China workshop that we are doing next year in 2016. We just got back. Darren and I just got back. Darren, tell us a little bit about China and how many photos did you get in your portfolio from China? Tell me that.
I think I got about 10, which is usually higher than most trips. And
Usually it's one.
Yeah, usually it's one. I have about 10 keepers, and just from the street photography scenes that we were able to capture, that's probably four in itself. I mean, we were walking away from that saying, these are going to be a portfolio shot. All we have to do is put a tiny bit of time editing them, and it just came out being a wonderful experience because everywhere you pointed a camera, especially in the areas we visited, was beautiful. I would probably compare it to somewhere really nice like Iceland or something like that, but with a little bit more of a different continent. An Asian theme.
Yeah, it was absolutely awesome. I love China. I've been doing a lot of traveling, but that's the only place that I booked a return trip before I even left. Absolutely awesome place. Nick, you're going to be joining me next year in China for this workshop. What excites you most about China? What has you wanting to go?
I have to say that just the landscape there is the most crazy, fantastical looking place I've ever seen in my life. It looks like you guys visited Whoville. It is just the most amazing set of mountains and winding rivers and stuff. And obviously the fishermen are just amazing. I think that, and not to mention the location, but I think we have such a cool collection of instructors at this. You got Brian and Erica. I think it's going to be really, really a pretty solid set of instructors. I'm excited to be a part of it.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be awesome. And we kept the price really, really, really reasonable for an international workshop. And we'll have four instructors there. I'm going to be there. Nick's going to be there. Erica Kaufman's going to be there. And Brian McGuckin. If you listen to the other podcasts on the Improved Photography Network, those are people you know well. And we're all going to be there. We're going to talk to you before, as soon as you pay your deposit. Once we get everybody kind of set up, we're going to invite everybody to a Facebook group so we can all communicate throughout the year preparing for the trip. And then as the trip gets close, we're going to call each person on Skype, spend some time with you, talk about your photography, where you are, where you want to go, what things you want to shoot, especially on the trip. And then we're going to customize the trip for every single person. You know, you really want to work on your flash photography, or you want to, you're more advanced and you want to work on multiple flashes. Great. We're going to put you with Nick Page and we're going to have a special group. You're going to go with two or three other people and just be with Nick all morning shooting cormorant fishermen or shooting a model in a location. You know, I just want to do landscapes. Great. You're going to go with Brian McGuckin and Jim one morning and you're going to go do this. Like, we're going to totally customize the workshop for everybody. I'm really excited about it. I've never seen anybody do a workshop quite like this that's so tailored to the individual. I mean, we're having a 1-to-5 student to instructor ratio is crazy. And you have multiple instructors that you'll get to work with during the week. Really, really going to be an awesome trip. So check that out at improvephotography.com/China. We already have some people who have signed up and we only have 20 seats. So definitely jump on this improvephotography.com/China. Get the details. We have lots of information there and come join us. Well, Jeff, tell us about the top 10 photos of the year. What's your thought there?
Well, okay, so before we start on that, I'd like to go through each of you and ask, how is it that you currently decide what goes in your portfolio? So let's start with Nick. Nick, how do you decide which shots go in your portfolio?
Well, mostly it's the ones that I can find. Like,
that's not a good reason.
No, I'm not the most organized guy in the world.
You don't have to tell us that, Nick. We know, man.
I know that collections are there. And I figure that there's probably some people that really utilize them well. I'm not one of those guys, but and so mostly I kind of have this mental note of what images I've taken this year that are probably my best. So I refer back to the steel trap that is this guy right here.
Okay.
So I don't have the most organized.
I see you printing
system.
And selling huge prints. I've seen on your Facebook, you're selling some big prints and stuff. So, I mean, I know you're out shooting a ton, but how do you decide which ones you're going to print, even if you haven't put them together in an exact portfolio?
So to be honest, it's kind of just how it's received on social media. Like, I know that if I post a photo and, you know, like five people like it, then I'm probably not going to print that image. But if it's one that people are just like, you know, sharing and commenting on, and it's really received really strongly, I'm thinking, okay, well, I'll print that one then and put your money where your mouth is. You know, that's kind of how I approach it. So I go by that, and I just kind of go by feel. And my goal is to print it before I forget about it, because it's only a matter of time before I hate that picture anyways, because, you know, after a month or two, I'm like, oh, I can't stand looking at that garbage. I need to get a new shot of that. So that's kind of where I don't have a top 10. I've got like a top 2, which is like in the last week or two.
All right. It's okay. Photo fad of the week. I gotcha.
Yeah, Pixoto pick of the week.
Exactly.
All right, Jim, what about you?
I Pixoto definitely helps me to know which photos are my best. But lately I've noticed some major discrepancies between the score that a photo gets on Pixoto and how well that photo is received on Facebook or on Instagram.
Sure. Yep.
And I used to really, really, really rely on Pixoto. Lately, it feels like maybe they're dealing with more spam or something going on there, because it feels like it's been a lot less reliable in the voting lately. And I mean, sometimes I take a photo and it gets up there and it doesn't do well. And hey, you know, it is what it is. Sometimes people just don't love your photo. But it is definitely weird when, you know, I share on the Facebook page and I know about how many likes a photo usually gets. And sometimes it'll just go bananas on the Facebook page and just die a horrible death on Pixoto for whatever reason. And so I keep seeing an increasing number of that. And so I haven't been relying as much on Pixoto lately. And so, you know, it's always going to be just a little bit of your personal preference and what you think is a good photo that's going to go in your portfolio, or what you're going to print to put in a studio or to sell. It's always a little bit tough, but I like at least getting feedback from other people by having somewhere to post it on social, and Pixoto, at least to get a little bit of feedback of, you know, did I just really love this location, or is this great? My eye is getting better for it over time, and I am doing a better job of putting away the I just had an awesome experience on this trip and really being able to look at the photo objectively. But that it's taken me a long time to get there, and still sometimes I just get it wrong. Rob, how about you? What do you do? How do you decide which photos are going in the portfolio?
Well, I think we all have those issues of gray lines of where we're supposed to draw that line and decide, because we start staring at it and we get bored, or we start staring at it and we're intrigued and we feel like, you know, I keep looking at it. Does it because it needs improvement, or because I'm addicted to this image? And I find that I primarily do weddings, and when I'm going through it, you kind of see the shot as you take it. So you kind of know, at least in one instance, that just made portfolio, at least in my mind. So when I go look at it, I'm going to double check. But I print everything out that I consider portfolio, because if I think it's good enough in that qualifying round, then it's good enough to show my potential future clients to kind of get them drawn in a little bit and have a little larger group to look at in that setting. But then I put everything aside in separate folder, you know, for the year to change up my advertising streams. And then I see how well my advertising is doing based on those image changes. So when those images are influencing a little more influx of clientele, I feel like they're working, and then I start saying, okay, it's time to update the website, because I definitely don't get to that soon enough, I'm sure. but mm-hmm. that kind of makes the decision for me. So,
yeah, the other thing with portraits is that the photos that you choose of a person are never, ever the same ones that the client chooses, because they're not looking at, wow, that is an epic photo. They're like, oh, the way I smiled made my nose scrunch up.
Yeah.
<It's> like, right. So the photos that I like best of portraits are never the ones that they pick. So I definitely wouldn't choose your portfolio pictures by what the client says. Like you said, Rob, you know, do it by how people respond to the advertising, etc.
How about you, Darren?
I've just been kind of random with it lately. I'll just go through and I import something into Lightroom, whether it's a portrait or whether it's a landscape shoot or anything like that. And if one picture just jumps off the screen, that'll be my 5-star image that I'm going to put some work into. And then from there, I might mark a couple, 3 or 4 stars and just to look at with fresh eyes the next day. And then I'll delete everything else. And hopefully I don't delete something bad or something actually that was a good photo that's a bad choice. But I just kind of, whatever just speaks to me at the moment. And then whatever I do the best job with editing. And if I accidentally do destructive editing inside Photoshop, hopefully I have a backup of that image so I can go ahead and not overdo it. But yeah, I just kind of gauged on social media, Pixoto, 500px, and just see how it does. But I need to be a little bit more proactive on updating my portfolio, because the redundancy of some of the images on my personal website doesn't really tell the story of who I am as a photographer.
Okay, so all of your answers are interesting to me, because it seems like it doesn't fit with a portfolio review kind of service. Because you'd have to figure out which pictures you're going to submit for that. And it sounds like if any of you decided, hey, it's time for me to go have someone take a look at them, you'd have to spend a fair amount of time figuring out which 10 or 15 or 20 you might submit for the review. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the thing that I want to suggest here that I think can really help a lot of people to improve their photography, and since that's what our podcast is all about, I think it could be really, really helpful.
That was
helpful.
Good, Jeff. That was slick. I'm going to be saying that a lot.
So, yeah, I mean, anyway. So what I recommend we do is... go through all of your photos that you take over a given year, January to December, and come up with your top 10. Go through and figure out all of those images are top 10. And have any of you ever tried to do that before?
Yeah, actually, I always have a running top 10.
Okay, good. So I did it for the first time last year, and it was tough. It was really, really hard to get down to 10. It wasn't very hard to narrow it down to like 50 or so. That was actually pretty simple. But boy, below that, it was really tough to start picking which babies were ugly uh-huh. at that point. And it was so hard, especially down to after 20, getting down there. And it was really, really tough for me to do that. But it really made me look at the photos differently as I evaluated them that way. It really made me look at what am I doing? And how are the pictures meaningful to me? Why would I throw one out versus another? It was a very good exercise. The other thing I learned in doing it last year, though, was I was not using collections very well. So, Nick, this is how how I think this can come into play and helping you a bit. Because as you're what I'm doing this year differently, and it's going to make a huge difference when I'm going to repeat this exercise in December. I have a collection group now, collection sets, what it's called. That's my top 10 set. And then I'm going to have a new collection underneath that collection set for every year. So I've got a 2014 that I went painstakingly through last year and built. But now as 2015, as I'm going through it, as I'm editing any pictures in post, and I'm like, ooh, I think that might be a contender for top 10 this year. I just quickly drop it off into that collection in the 2015 thing. And at the end in December, I'm going to have, I don't know, probably 50, 60 different candidates for the top 10. And now I don't have to go find at least those. Now I already have a starting point where it's easy for me to say, wow, these are the ones I thought were really good through the year, and start on doing that and narrowing it down. And then year over year comparing it. So I'm really excited to see 2014 versus 2015. How do my top 10s compare? How different was it between those 2 years? Did I learn some things? And I'm hoping I look at 2014 and say, what was I thinking? Those photos aren't nearly as good. And I've really grown as a photographer. I hope it's not that I look and like, yeah, it's about the same. That would be really bad.
That, or man, I've gotten a lot worse.
Or yeah, a lot worse. Yeah. But I just think that's a really important tool. And the reason I wanted to talk about it today was next week is June. So you're halfway through the year next week or in a couple weeks. And so it's a good time to look through the first 6 months. And if you haven't started doing it yet, maybe make it a little easier on yourself to go through this exercise, gather them together, go create that collection set of top 10s, and then a new collection under that collection set of 2015, and go through your pictures that you've taken since January and pick the ones that are going to be candidates for top 10. Maybe you could try to whittle it down to the top 10 of the first half of the year if you wanted, but at least pulling out the really good ones so that you have a good starting point for it coming up. So that's a suggestion I think is something that could really help everyone to improve. Oh, one other point I wanted to make was then, you know, if you ever wanted to use the portfolio review service that Improved Photography offers, that would be a really simple way. Now, if you keep these collections and you maintain them, when you upload, when you have the chance to share your shots with the reviewer that's going to give you your portfolio review built in, you already have it ready to go. There's not any mad dash to figure out which of my photos are worthy of even sharing with somebody.
I have a hard time talking about the portfolio review service because it sounds like an ad. I guess it kind of is, but we hardly make any money off the portfolio reviews, let me tell you. That's a service that nobody else is offering anywhere online, is portfolio reviews, because it takes your time to do. And usually websites are trying to make resources that millions of people can visit and not just individuals, but it's really inexpensive. And that's just something we want to have out there so that you can get some direction on your photography. I have not heard even one tiny little complaint from any person that has bought a portfolio review. In fact, I've had like ecstatic reviews from the people that have got portfolio reviews. Just because, you know, you do this, you look through, you pick your top 10 photos or whatever, you submit it in there, and then this feedback that we're talking about, that you're always like kind of wondering about your photos and where you think, like, you can get an actual answer from a professional photographer. It's really a cool, interesting service that we offer. So check that out on Improved Photography. Just on the sidebar, you'll see that there. And it's only $39 to get a portfolio review. So really reasonable, something that I think a lot of photographers should at least consider. Or, you know, find a professional photographer in your city who will just sit down with you at lunch, or, you know, whatever you do, whether you do it with us or somebody else, it really doesn't matter to me. I just think it's hugely valuable to do that. And you'll find all kinds of things that you just didn't notice was kind of cropping up in your photos. Cropping, get that one? See, I'm slick too, Jeff. Oh boy. Kind of things that are cropping up in your photography that you probably have never noticed. Like, I did a portfolio review today for somebody who's been a very supportive listener of the podcast and has taken classes over time. And I looked at the pictures. They're all professional. And there were just a couple things like really had to change. Like, he just had a lot of headroom in his photos, which I spared him Nick, because Nick would just go after him like a hound dog. That's Nick's pet peeve, is too much headroom. And the photos were looking a little bit static. They were very professional, well lit, properly exposed, good focus, but they just didn't quite have the creative lighting in them. And so, like, how long is it going to take somebody to realize that, oh, I've kind of fallen in a rut with this and I need to switch up these couple things? It just can really propel your photography to just sit down with somebody and get advice. Don't take everything they say as the gospel truth. You know, it's always going to be a little bit of opinion, but at least hearing it, I guarantee if you get a portfolio review from us or anybody else, you'll look at your photos and you'll be like, whoa, I had no idea I was doing that, or just a few things that will really surprise you. Rob, have you ever received a portfolio review? I'm sure you've done them from others. Have you gotten a portfolio review from others?
In my professional career, yes, a few times. I've gone back to earlier mentors who I had worked for and said, so I'm out on my own doing this. Can you take a look? So I already knew them personally, and I don't know if that softened the blow when they were telling me the truth about all the problems I had, but you know, it was honest and it was extremely helpful, because you're right. It just kind of, it kicks you in the butt a little reality check. And it's not like you go into it looking to be torn down. You go into it with an open mind, because you're going to hear good things and bad, but take it with a grain of salt and see if you can make it into better, you know, just make that improvement. So,
well, yeah. And sometimes it's just a relief, because all the time I'll get people that are like, ah, oh, my photos are just not sharp. They're not sharp. And they'll send them it to me. I look at them and I'm like, no, they're fine. There's no problem with the sharpness here. So sometimes I get people that are really worried about something and you can just say, hey, no, that's fine. Let's work on this other thing now. And so it can really go both ways. What's been your experience with portfolio reviews, Darren? About getting portfolio reviews. Have you received a portfolio review?
A while ago, I did went from a guy named Jim Harmer when I was one of his students at Improved Photography. And
who's that nutcase?
I don't know, but he helped me grow a lot as a photographer. And honestly, I submitted it, and I just didn't really have any expectations. And it didn't really take the wind out of my sails or anything like that when I got some feedback that said, yeah, maybe you shouldn't shoot that cow with an ear tag, and I'm not really getting what's going on with the picture here. And it made me start thinking about composition a little bit more, and even reaching out to other photographers locally and going on photo walks with them, just meeting up with them and seeing what they're coming up with, and then also seeing what you're lacking with your vision, I think is extremely beneficial. I think that the more open-minded you are with your craft, the better that you're going to be as a photographer. Because if you get stuck in one rut of one style, how can you expect to grow? I mean, you have to branch out. I don't want to say not specialize in anything, but I think that it's also good to explore different avenues, because you could find a core competency in something that you never expected.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So, all right. So we're getting our top 10 photos together. You know, we talked about getting a portfolio review. Let's say you are just wanting to put these on your website. How many photos are you guys actually putting on your website? Is 10 the number, or do you have more, fewer?
I see Nick smiling. So,
yeah, just look like a knowing grin there, Nick.
I just keep putting them on there until my website crashes. I haven't reached my bandwidth limit, so apparently I don't have enough. I think like in my landscapes section of my website, I've got like, I don't know, too many, probably like 50. I don't know.
Oh.
I haven't counted
them. So why do you
have
so many though?
Well, because I forget to take the old ones down, I guess. I don't know.
Okay.
I put the newest stuff up that way the newest stuff is first in the little slideshow galleries. And eventually I do go through and I start weeding out the ones where I'm like, oh God, why is that up there? And I take that down, and that's pretty much the way I cull my photos on there. So I take down the ones that I can't stand, but I leave up the ones that I feel represent my work, and I shoot a lot of pictures, so there's a lot of pictures on my website. I don't know, like, kind of how I approach it, I guess. Don't talk to me about organization.
It's not too late to change.
How about you, Jeff? So is 10 kind of your number?
No. I think a top 10 every year is a good objective, because it makes you figure out what are your best shots for the year. So 20 could be okay for a year. It might be good, but boy, it was really good for me to evaluate that. It really made me take a critical eye. I think I got it down to 13. I was like, oh man, I have to get three more I have to get rid of. How am I going to do that? And it was really, really tough. So I think it's helpful on a yearly basis to have that be that way. For me, I think a portfolio under each category, I'm targeting 20. And I currently don't have it that way. It's something, so I'm not an example of this yet.
Oh, so all that hard time you just gave.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's, it's, and honestly, part of what I need to do is I take panoramas a lot. So a lot of those are the ones that I want in my portfolio. The websites don't, the templates and stuff, they don't deal with them very well. They look terrible when they're rotating through. So I need to pick some that are not landscapes, or specially craft some of the panoramas so that they'll work better on the site and make it be one of the 20. But that's what I want to do. I want to make it so that in each area of emphasis, for me, it's portraits and landscapes. I want to have 20 of each that are my best 20 overall. Cool. So that would be another objective I guess I'll have will be, as I get my top 10 for 2015, and then I have my top 20 in those areas, I'm going to say, well, are any of these worthy of replacing, not adding to, but replacing one in my portfolio, so that it's very representative of the work. I want a lot of variety. I don't want the same shots over and over in different times of the day or whatever showing up. It needs to be more interesting than that. So the people want to be like, ooh, I want to see the next one and the next one and the next one. Mm-hmm. And then want to, you know, hire me for stuff. So that's my goal.
Very cool. Yeah, I always have my top 10, you know, my rolling top 10 or whatever my very best are at that point. You can see it on my Squarespace site. It's at photographyidaho.com, or just search Jim Harmer portfolio and it'll come right up. But I think it's great to have that. And it's hard, you know, to pick your very favorites at the start, but eventually you start caring less about your children and you're just like, just pick some and you can put them up. Well, before we end, we want to share a doodad of the week. Mine is the 1 Second Every Day app. It is on the iPhone. I don't know if it's available for Android, but 1 Second Every Day. I think it costs $2.99. So I'm not the 365 photographer that takes a photo every day. That's just not my style of photography. I would rather, you know, shoot, you know, once or twice a month and do something really epic. That's just what really excites me, is that more produced shoot. But the 1 Second Every Day app is actually pretty cool. I've been doing it and it's really enjoyable. What it is it just, you take 1 second of video every single day, and then it makes this cool calendar view. And at the end of the year, you know, you can make a video and stuff of just 1 second clips of what your day looked like every day. And so it's really fun that I'm not trying to create art with it. It's just kind of a way to remember your year and stuff. So when I'm like, last night I was out playing soccer with the kids at night, just at the park. And so, you know, when it's just like, snaps and it's like, oh, this is my moment. This is my 1 second of the day, the second that I, you know, if all the other seconds went away and this was my favorite second of the day, I just grab my iPhone and grab 1 second of video. Now, if you get longer than 1 second or whatever, it helps you trim it. It has kind of a cool editor and stuff. But it's a pretty neat concept to have 1 second of video every day. And so that's something I've been using and really enjoying. Darren, how about you?
Mine are the Bose QC for Quiet Comfort 20i, and they have the ones that are i is for iPhone. They're noise canceling headphones. They're great for travel. And we actually had a listener of the podcast, Mike, send me a message saying, you should definitely recommend these on the show. And I wore them on the way over to China. It was enabled me to get a little bit of shut eye and, you know, cancel out crying babies. And I'll probably get him in trouble because he said it cancels out his wife's voice. So he said they're pretty powerful things. But
that is a pretty powerful tool.
Yeah. And since Jeff mentioned our last podcast, Music to Code By, I thought it was pretty cool to be able to cancel out some of those, you know, different nuances that are in the room that could be distracting you, whether it's traffic or your wife, perhaps. They're just really great for canceling out noise. I'm wearing the QC25s, which I do like a lot, but these are a little less cumbersome. They're not really sweat resistant, so I wouldn't wear them for working out, but travel and you want to fit something small in your bag and be on the go. They lasted us about 20 hours before the battery even came close to dying.
Very cool. Jeff?
So I'm going to go with a filter, the Tiffin 77mm circular polarizer. And to go with it, because I have a variety of lenses, so I went and found what was the biggest diameter of the lens I've got. And so I bought then the metal step-down ring set from Photodiax so that I can put my filter on any one of my lenses that way. And it seems it's really great. The price is what's most impressive. I know I'm not sure if the quality is as good as the more expensive stuff, but so far, I'm really happy with the results. I'm really happy with how it's working. So that's going to be my pick. It's $40 for the Tiffin 77mm polarizer, and then $14 for the step-down ring set. And now I have a polarizer I can put on any one of my lenses.
Okay, not to take us down a rat hole, but but are you guys? What's the last? Let me ask it this way, because if I ask you, do you use them, you'll say yes. What's the last time you put a circular polarizer on a lens?
Yesterday.
Day before yesterday.
Really? How about you,
I was
Rob?
Shooting film. I was shooting film.
It was that long ago?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I haven't done it on my digital at all.
Darren, how about you?
It's been months. Yeah. Not as often as what I thought when I purchased it.
I have a lot of filters. I bet I use a, well, I don't know. Every once in a while a shoot comes up that I just put on a polarizer for like 3 days straight that is just kind of really fits the situation. Like, for example, when I go up into the high mountain lakes in Idaho, it's like polarizerville. Like, I just want a polarizer for everything, to take the glare off the leaves, to take the glare off the water. That's polarizer time. But I bet it's been a good 7-8 months since I've used a polarizer. Because when I'm shooting landscapes or nature photography, it's almost always at sunrise. And a polarizer just isn't going to do hardly anything for you at sunrise, except for taking the glare off the water. But when we're talking about the sky, where we usually use the polarizer for the sky, polarizer is not going to do anything for you at sunrise, really. So I think a polarizer is a great tool. Everybody should have one. But I was just curious. It's just something that I've been thinking about. And I've just realized lately, especially when I bought the Tamron 15 to 30, that you can't put a polarizer on, or at least not reasonably. I thought, man, this is going to drive me crazy. And then I really thought about it, and I was like, you know what? It's been a long time since I've needed a polarizer. Maybe this isn't that big of a deal.
Well, and to be honest, I only used it yesterday because I just got it. So,
admit it, you're in your living room.
I was at the reservoir at the end of the street. That's where I was using it. So,
but that's a good recommendation, Jeff. I think Tiffin makes decent polarizers for hobbyist photographers. They're, you know, not as nice as the B+W or the Lee or the Singray, but it's hardly any difference. And so, you know, if you're still building out a lens collection and other stuff like that, just buy the Tiffin and be done with it.
I was going to say, I spent this last weekend photographing waterfalls, and I find that I've got a 3-stop and a 10-stop neutral density filter. And if you're in the shade, like, those are just too much. Like, it makes the shutter speed too slow to show the texture and the motion in the water. So I find that just like that little bit of light that you cut with a polarizer makes it about right in a shade situation.
Yeah, that works.
So waterfalls are a great time to use them, I think, just because it
cuts. So you're using your polarizer really as a really lightweight neutral density, yeah.
Exactly. Or if I'm shooting in the middle of the day when I don't really like to shoot, but I'm like trying to get something, you know, I happen to be driving by Mount Adams like I was, and I'm like, well, I got it to at least take the picture. So I throw on the polarizer and like, well, we'll at least make the sky blue or something. I don't know. So
cool.
That's when I use it.
And Nick, your doodad?
So, as listeners of the Portrait Session podcast might already know, I just had a huge computer meltdown. My computer was down for a week, so I ended up having to install a new solid-state drive. Before that, I had just a Western Digital green drive, and I just upgraded to the Samsung Pro, the one with the little red tab, SSD drive, and I cannot believe how much faster it is. It is like night and day. Like, I'm using a brand new computer. So putting my operating system and my Lightroom catalog on a solid state drive has sped up my computer so much. So that kind of has to be my recommendation this week, is the solid state drives. I went with the Samsung one because Jeff said it was good, and I trust Jeff because he's a nerd.
That's right.
Yeah, no, that is a great way to breathe new life into a machine that's just feeling a little bit sluggish, is to put an SSD in. It's not real complicated. You can just get on Amazon. They have the little connector to go from USB to eSATA that can plug. So basically all it does is it's making a clone of your current drive onto the SSD before you even plug it in, and then you turn the computer off, take it apart, and slip in that SSD, and it's like nothing changed. All your icons are in the exact same spot. It is the exact same computer, just now with the SSD. So it's a really, I mean, if you're not technically inclined at all, I'm sure it's a challenge. But for most people, it's not terribly difficult to do, and boy, does that change your computer.
It does.
Rob?
Yeah, I was pulling up the Expo Imaging Expo Disc, and it's a white balance filter. And kind of like Jeff was saying, with the finding the right size and the step down rings, rather than doing step down rings for this one, what I have done is I got the largest size I could get. It won't fit over my 14 to 24 because there are barely any filters that will fit over that lens. But it's an 82 millimeter, so I can hold it over flush against it because it's forgetting your white balance. But also, if you shoot from where your picture is going to be captured, the scene itself, if you can have that access, you can get perfect exposure value from that direction, seeing where the light's coming in and meter perfectly in camera, because it's giving you that wonderful camera lie of 18% gray through that filter. So makes kind of two good things happening.
I've been looking at these expo discs and I've been really interested in getting one, just because there's so many times where I'm struggling with color casts. Like if I'm in the shade and there's green leaves everywhere, man, I struggle so hard with my white balance after the fact when I go to try to make it neutral again. So it helps a lot with color casts and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Look, but why don't you just fix it afterward? I just shoot weddings, it seems so much easier to just shoot the darn thing. And then, like, how hard is it to just grab your Lightroom slider and slide it? Like,
it's not hard.
Because I'll have 1,400 images to go through. So yeah, I'd rather have a bracket or a section.
You select the first one and the last one and you slide it. And it changes from
one side of the room to the other because of the mixed light changing of what you have. So if you have the whole room kind of balancing out, it gets you a hell of a lot closer, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Right, and if you're doing an outside shoot where you're under green leaves and you're in the shade, the distance they are from those leaves changes the amount of color cast. So mm-hmm. like you can get that first setting and then sync it across your photos. And then the last ones are like way too magenta because they're further away from those leaves. So color has turned into a constant struggle with me.
But this doesn't solve that problem unless you're taking a white balance reading like every time they move.
It's true.
It's crazy. You people are crazy.
I saw this coming. I think if someone would have recommended a teleconverter, the same thing would have happened. Jim would have been like, friends, don't let friends use teleconverters.
Or expo discs.
Yep. I don't get it. So many people love it. And I'm teasing you guys. Everybody shoots differently. If it works, then that's great. But just for the way that I shoot, I just do not understand the gray card thing. It just does not make any sense to me. Furthermore, whenever I do shoot with a gray card, I look at the photo, I'm like, ooh, everybody looks like they're in the morgue. It's I mean, technically, yeah, that's right, but it always looks too blue.
Although these expo discs, they have warming gels, so you can actually compensate for that.
Oh, you know what Lightroom has? A warming slider. You just wore it. And the speed thing, I just don't understand the speed argument. Because, let's talk about the scenario that you guys have got me fired up here.
I'm ready.
Let's talk about the scenario that you talked about, Nick, where you have somebody, they're next to leaves, and then they're closer to the leaves, and they're further away from the leaves, and they're in different lighting. Well, if you took one white balance reading with something like an expo disc or a gray card or whatever else you decide to do, then every single photo is wrong because the white balance changes on every one. If instead you let the camera use auto white balance, going to change for each one. Yes, it's sometimes wrong, but it's going to adjust by how close they are to those leaves. And then if you select all of the pictures and you adjust one of them, then they've all come to correct and the auto white balance has pushed it a little bit one way or a little bit other to compensate for those differences. It's the very fastest way to get this done. You people are driving me nuts.
So, okay. I don't use it when I'm outside often. I like auto for that, being close. It's the indoor mixed lighting. The indoor mix lighting is where it's a really big problem. So that's why I use that as a just quick starting place. I know exactly what I'm going to do because the second you walk outside, if you forget to change it, everything's whack. So you know, you have to be watching it. Not so much that I'm going to be changing it every picture, every scene, but there are a few scenes throughout a particular shoot or a particular day that I'll want to use that to make sure the white balance is dialed in a lot closer than the auto is going to get me.
It's a good recommendation. You guys know I'm giving you a hard time. It's a very good recommendation. And the vast majority of photographers disagree with me on this point. I just personally don't understand it because it's just not hard to adjust in Lightroom. And I don't mean like some people will, you say that and I always get the comment on Facebook or somebody will somehow find my email and email in and they say something like, get it right in camera, Jim. And it's But why? There are good reasons to get it right in camera. Like, for example, so it saves you time in post-processing. But the situation that I'm talking about is it takes me longer when I'm there to set the white balance and get it all perfect. And it's distracting me from doing creative things, just working with the couple and stuff, when there will be zero difference in the image quality if I just do it after the fact.
I'm going to get you a gray card.
Do it. I will have nightmares every night.
Little gray cards.
But I fully admit, I'm definitely in the minority. I think most people love it. And that's a great recommendation, Rob. I hope you recognize I'm just messing with you.
I did.
Well, Rob, tell us a little bit about Take and Talk Picks.
Well, Take and Talk Picks is a podcast I started after I found my passion for teaching. I ended up working at the community college I attended years ago, and I really like getting the information out there. And I've been finding that there's a lot out there that talks business on photography, but there are even more that you have to pay for to get that access in seminars and workshops that people are charging for. So I wanted some sort of resource that's not just watching a video online and learning how to do the new technique of shooting whatever or the next piece of gear that's coming out, but more so the business end, because we find ourselves sitting down wondering why the phone's not ringing. And we're like, well, we love shooting. We get to do what we love, right? But there's a lot more to running a photography business and making that happen. So, and I'm hardly the resource for getting all that information. So what I do is I interview photographers, and 3 days a week, I bring in, we go through some questions, and they're very similar from show to show, but we go through questions and try to tell the story of their journey and the ups and downs of their business, the ins and outs, the do's and don'ts. So it helps get the whole photo world out there to relate to what's going on in the business world.
Very cool. It's a great resource. Definitely check it out at takeandtalkpicks.com. So Rob, thank you for being on the podcast. It was a pleasure to talk with you and mess around with you a little bit.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a good conversation tonight, and we'll see you in a week.